Good afternoon, Judge Barksdale, Judge Smith, and Judge Prado. About this time, you're probably looking for a seventh inning stretch.
If you need to arrange your papers, go ahead. It's okay.
It's okay. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As the court may know, I represent the plaintiffs, Jim Moore Insurance Agency, Inc., and Jim Moore. I also represented Mr. Moore's wife, Blanche Moore, who was a defendant in the reconventional demand. To cut through to what I think is one of the more important legal arguments for the court's consideration, I would point you to a matter where I suggest to you that there is a great deal of agreement between the parties appellant and appellee, and that is the issue with respect to res judicata, or preclusive effect, of the California case, the Adkins versus State Farm case, which in this particular matter, both parties argued carried preclusive effect, but to a different degree. The Adkins case is a case in which my client, Mr. Moore, and or his company were a party. And in that case, they sought declaratory judgment relief on a contract issue involving State Farm's implementation of a program called the License Staff Agreement Program, the LSA, which 27 State Farm agents in the California case contended violated their agent's agreement. Now, there was a contract called the AA4 agreement that was pervasive among the agents, and it set out the duties and responsibilities of the parties. That contractual agreement made the agents independent contractors and gave them exclusive rights of control over their employees. It is an interesting anecdotal comment that historically the direct writer companies like State Farm and Allstate and others moved from employee relationships with their agents to independent contractor relationships with their agents over a period of time and shifted to the agents' expense responsibilities and gave them complete control over all of the operations of soliciting and sale of the insurance. And specifically in this contract, gave to Mr. Moore and the other agents their control over their employees. It is that degree of control that was unequivocal, which the California courts, in a declaratory judgment action, decided was breached. Now, the degree of disagreement that occurs here between the parties deals with how far the preclusive effect should go. Historically, the California suit was filed in 2001 after this LSA program was initiated in 2000. It did not go to trial and become a judgment of the trial court in California until the time of Katrina, August 29, 2005. Now, before that, however, in 2003, Jim Moore filed in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Louisiana a lawsuit for damages and other types of relief. He sought no damages in the California court. The California court had before it then a declaratory judgment action. When that suit started, it also had before it a claim for injunction. And in 2005, the district court denied that injunction in August, after the August trial. However, before the trial in August, there was in April of that year a change of circumstances between Mr. Moore's agency and State Farm. His contract was terminated. So any injunction issue with respect to his being given protection against the implementation of the LSA agreement because it was a breach of contract became moot. Moreover, there was in June of 2005, again before the August 2005 decision of the trial court, a decision by Judge Livoday of the Eastern District, where he found that there were grounds for enjoining State Farm's interference with Mr. Moore's conduct of his business. This was after the termination of the contract. And so to whatever extent there might be injunctive remedy available to Mr. Moore after the termination of his contract, any issues there, we suggest, were decided by the Eastern District and not before the district court in California. Now, we fast forward to 2007, when in January of 2007, the Court of Appeal in California reversed the trial court and decided that the acts of State Farm in implementing the LSA agreement were a breach of contract, and then issued an injunction. Strangely enough, in February of 2005, State Farm had filed in the district court a motion for summary judgment arguing issue preclusion, res judicata, and that the trial court decisions in August of 2005 in California were ball game over, preclusive, res judicata. But as soon as the decision came out of the Court of Appeal and we argued in response, State Farm shifted its argument, seeing, of course, that it did not want Mr. Moore to have the benefit of the decision on the declaratory judgment that the actions of State Farm were preclusive. It was not only the issue with respect to the preclusive effect of the breach of contract declaratory judgment action, about which we complain, that made for what we say was gross error at the trial court level. Obviously, we asked the judge to make that a decision of law. It was a decision of law. And it should set up Mr. Moore then for his right to claim damages on the subsequent occurring events. The subsequent occurring events were that in August of 2002, Mr. Moore was told that he could no longer sell new business for State Farm because he wouldn't force his employees to sign the LSA agreement, providing to State Farm from his employees a non-compete and recognizing State Farm's right to claim trade secrets as to its insurers. In 2000, when State Farm implemented the agreement, it said, if you don't have your employees sign these contracts, then you're not going to be able to talk to home office, or to the regional office and conduct business on behalf of State Farm through those employees. And then in 2002, the next ratchet up was, not only are you not going to be able to talk to us, you're not going to be able to sell new business. And then ultimately in 2005, the contract was terminated. There were a series of events or occurrences which made for distinctly different damage claims, no doubt about it. There was no real debate about the claims after 2005. State Farm even conceded at the trial court level that there was no preclusive effect to claims for damages after 2005. But they argued that the preclusive effect was not against them, but for them. Now, how could you say that a judgment rendered against you was favorable to you? Well, their argument was this. Their argument was that despite the fact Mr. Moore had filed in August of 2003 a suit for damages in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Louisiana, he should have filed that in California, because California law required that all the claims be brought in California. Well, it doesn't require that. No law requires that. And moreover, if one chooses to file his claim for damages in the Eastern District and a complaint for declaratory judgment relief in California, one certainly can. On a completely different, unsubstantiated theory that where one has only one occurrence, one must file all the claims as to that one occurrence in a single lawsuit, State Farm argued that where here, over a period of 2000 to 2002 to 2005, with different occurrences, all of those claims should have been filed in 2001. Obviously, that couldn't have happened as a practical matter, because what occurred in 2002 and 2005 could not have been filed in 2001. And there was never a claim for damages there. Instead, that claim for damages was brought in the Eastern District. The plaintiffs take the position and have taken the position since this case was properly postured for trial that the legal issue is very simple. We submit to you it's an issue for de novo review. We submit to you it's an issue that you must decide, and it's an issue which is very simply in our favor. The law having been decided on the declaratory judgment action in favor of Mr. Moore and his company, State Farm is bound by that decision, and the only thing left was a claim for damages. I'm watching my clock. It says 4 minutes. Is this 4 minutes on my unreserved time or reserved time, or is this total for 15?
You get this 4 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
So my 5 minutes of rebuttal are not on here. Okay, good. Thanks. My appreciation of the position of State Farm is that it wished to have that issue of whether or not there was a breach of contract tried again. And it succeeded. It was not successful on its motion for summary judgment, but in a motion in limine, it said to Judge Fallon, allow us not to talk about this at the trial. Without finding what the 403 prejudice might be, Judge Fallon said, okay, we won't talk about that because I don't know how to tell the jury the effect of the California decision. I submitted to him that the effect is very simple. We have only issues with respect to damages. Because to the extent that
the jury found no damages.
The jury found no breach of contract and no damages. However, the law between the parties in this case was that there was a breach of contract. Hence, the issue of damages was the only thing there for consideration if you apply preclusive effect res judicata of the Atkins case. And that was one of our big concerns about which we complained from the beginning. Now, there's so much that I suppose we've put in the brief that we don't need to hit upon, but I will also point out to you the second major point that we have in this case is with respect to the testimony of State Farm on the issue with respect to its performance of the contract and whether it breached it, and the distinctly different, if not false, testimony offered by State Farm at trial from what it sent in a letter a week after trial. In the trial, they said Mr. Moore had been paid all of his termination payment. They'd fulfilled their obligations under the contract. But 10 days after, they sent a letter to him and say, oops, we underpaid you. We take the position, the testimony, which is clearly false based upon what they've now admitted, entitles us to a new trial. We take the position that where State Farm testifies that it had not performed an audit, and that there was, however, no information which State Farm had that would show that Mr. Moore was underpaid or not paid everything that's due him for term pay. But then 10 days afterwards, their letter, which we attach as an exhibit, says, within the last few months, we've performed an audit, and it shows you were underpaid. That puts the jury in a position of, at the very least, having two things for it, which I submit to you are beyond question as a matter of law. One, there was a breach of contract, according to the Atkins decision between these parties. That was the law of the case between these parties. That should have been put to the jury. And there was an underpayment, which represents a breach of contract, according to the after-the-trial evidence revealed by State Farm, which entitles us to a new trial. So we submit to you that there's legal error, which you should review for de novo consideration, and there's error of misrepresentation, which entitles us to new trial. Obviously, we raised all these issues. I won't say a whole lot about the counterclaim in my last 59 seconds, but the counterclaim that was brought by State Farm seeks damages. I will tell you that it was our position all along that it sought damages. State Farm said it didn't want any damages. It just wanted to offset whatever recovery Mr. Moore and his company may have. They raise on appeal now their claim for offsetting damages, which the trial judge said they had abandoned, and which, of course, we contended that their pleadings had never abandoned, and they seem to affirm by virtue of that which they raised after the trial, a motion for declaratory relief to obtain liquidated damages in the form of the termination of Mr. Moore's annuity, his monthly stipend that he receives after the termination of his contract. So we submit to you that that shows that State Farm intended to present, did present an argument, and obviously we submit improperly a picture of Mr. Moore's having damaged State Farm, although they represented to the court that that issue was not before the court. So that confusion, we think, also entitles us to a new trial. I'll reserve my last few minutes, if I may. Thank you. Appreciate your attention.
Mark.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Mark Mallory, and I'm counsel here on behalf of State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company, State Farm Fire and Casualty Company, State Farm General Insurance Company, and State Farm Life Insurance Company. And with me at counsel table today is my client representative, John Groves, in-house counsel with State Farm at their corporate headquarters in Bloomington, Illinois. I find myself in the unusual position today of defending a jury verdict in favor of an insurance company rendered in post-Katrina New Orleans. My opponent, Mr. Thornhill, and I have been aggressively litigating this case against each other for more than 5 years now. And he's a very skilled orator. Anyone who's read the entire trial court record and the 7 days of trial testimony and read all the exhibits, you can see what a skilled attorney he is. My problem with his position and his argument is that the district judge and the jury listened to all these same arguments and rejected all of them. The other problem that I see with the arguments that my opponent is making is that there are certain rules related to appellate practice for the federal court system that I think have been ignored by my opponent. If you look at page 21 through 32 of their brief, for example, there's no citation to the trial court record there. If you read through the entire brief, all 61 pages, there's not a single citation to any Louisiana state court decision except in the footnote in page 49, and no citation to Louisiana Civil Code at all. And I think there's a very good and telling reason why that is. The reason is that there is no dispute in this case about the applicable Louisiana state law to this case. Judge Fallon prepared excellent jury instructions, and he thought through them very well, and the sufficiency and correctness of Judge Fallon's jury instructions about Louisiana law are not before this court. The judge very thoughtfully distilled from Louisiana Civil Code and the case law the correct law related to contracts and contract interpretation principles and put forth some very clear jury instructions. In fact, this court would not even need to do any legal research regarding Louisiana state law because of Judge Fallon's instructions are not in dispute here. And there's no issue on appeal regarding the jury instructions. There are a number of other deficiencies that we see in the appellant's brief. They refer to excluded evidence. For example, correspondence from Betty Candies on page 30, that document was excluded from evidence. They refer on page 30 to Mr. Moore's deposition testimony. That was not part of the trial record. My opponent's brief is replete with statements of fact that don't have any citations to the trial court record, full of arguments of law that don't have any citations to case law or other supporting legal authority. Repeated references to what State Farm supposedly argued at various points or conceded during the course of the case without any record reference to support those statements. And we submit that it's not incumbent on State Farm or this court to try to sift through the entire record of a trial court proceeding that lasted for 4 years or a 7-day jury trial to try to find any evidence, any piece of evidence that might support the plaintiff's arguments. The fact is that many contentions in my opponent's brief are simply unfounded and supportable. I would suggest to you that we know for certain what is not on appeal to this court today.
Let me ask you this. I'm looking at page 14 of their brief, and it says standard of review is that federal standard of review for a jury's verdict is one of reasonableness and cites Marcel versus Placid Oil. Is that the standard?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That's not the standard. In fact, we cited contrary case law and pointed that out that that's not correct. In a case like this where the jury ruled in favor of State Farm, this court is supposed to be especially deferential to a jury verdict and should uphold the jury finding unless there is no legally sufficient basis for the jury to have ruled as it did. So there's certainly not a legitimate argument to try to guess whether it was reasonable or not. That's clearly not the standard that the court should apply. There's also no errors before the court regarding the issues that actually were submitted to the jury. And the purpose of this appeal is not to re-argue all the same arguments that were made to the lower court below. So, since we're not here to re-argue the case, the question becomes, what are we here to actually argue about? It's nice to know that we've apparently distilled the case down to three issues that we can really focus on, but I think it's critical to note that there are only three claims submitted to the jury: breach of contract from both sides, a fraud misrepresentation allegation from the plaintiff, and intentional infliction of emotional distress claim from the plaintiff. It's important to note what Judge Fallon said post-trial. I think he took an extra step to say something he didn't really have to say. He said, not one of the jury's findings on any of the claims submitted to it is against the weight of the evidence. Moreover, and he just added this, I don't think he was required to, but he pointed this out. Moreover, the court finds that this case has been litigated fairly and that the ends of justice have undoubtedly been served in this matter. That's what Judge Fallon took pains to say in his post-trial rulings. Now, this is and always has been an independent contractor relationship where, by law, Mr. Moore had a duty of loyalty and fidelity to State Farm. And I'm not going to go through all the facts that were before the jury to support the findings in favor of State Farm, because that's not my burden. I spent an hour in closing arguments summarizing all of it to the jury, and I would defer and refer the court to that argument in the transcript on the last day of trial. But I do think it's important to note what Ms. Mary Bitzer said, who was a senior vice president over the five-state area for State Farm that included Louisiana at the time. She said to the jury, the core of our agency contract is a relationship with our agents, and most important is this ability to work together, agree to communicate with each other. And if we don't even have that, then in essence, we don't have an agency relationship. This was very sad because, in a sense, we had failed. We failed to get to a place where we could openly engage with our agent. Mr. Moore was the name of State Farm in his community of Destrehan. And when we have an agent there who is not working and not cooperating with his principal, with his leadership team, it's a huge concern. I pride myself on trying to open doors of communication with people. And I had tried through my leadership team, I tried through my agency management team, I tried through Tim McFadden, who was the vice president of Louisiana, and I thought, I've got to give it one more shot. So I decided, before I sent the termination letter, I wanted to see if I could reach out to Jimmy to have him come meet with me and just talk to me. It's kind of off the charts, I know. I've had some difficult situations. I've reached out to many agents, and sometimes they were challenging, but I've never gone this far. So clearly there's evidence to support the jury finding, and the standard that the plaintiff has to meet is not established. My opponent's first assignment of error in their brief is pretty perplexing to me. Their argument is that somehow the court erred in entering judgment in accordance with the jury verdict. That's a strange argument, to be honest with you, because I think the judge is almost required to do that unless he finds some significant error. My opponent's argument regarding Rule 60 is also equally perplexing. There's Rule 60 motion. They seem to be saying two things regarding Rule 60. One is they say, because I made a claim in my counterclaim against Mr. Moore stating that if he breached his contract, that he would not be entitled to any further termination payments under his contract. And therefore, I was asking the court to allow us not to have to pay those anymore because I made that claim in the counterclaim. And because I made that claim in open court in front of the judge, in front of the jury, in my closing argument, specifically telling the jury, if you find a breach of contract by Mr. Moore, the effect of that is that he would lose his termination payments under the contract. Because I made that argument in open court, somehow that's a Rule 60 violation. Seems a little strange to me that someone could contend that Rule 60 would be violated when I made an argument in open court and my opponent didn't even object to it during the trial. I don't think that's a valid Rule 60 argument. The second Rule 60 argument was brought up related to the testimony of Mr. Jonathan Williams. Now, Mr. Jonathan Williams was the expert in-house at State Farm who dealt with agency contracts and compensation. And he basically said, I haven't done an audit But my understanding is that the $6,000 per month that Mr. Moore is receiving in termination payments is the amount that he's supposed to be getting. It's basically what he said in his sworn testimony. Now, a couple of days after the trial, Mr. Moore was sent a letter, and it was attached to my opponent's Rule 60 motion, and it said, there may have been some errors in some estimated life insurance, and it's quoted in the brief, actually. There may be some estimated errors, but it doesn't affect the actual termination payments. Now, the termination payments are calculated according to all the documents that are in the record stating what his compensation was. And the way it works is basically it's 60 months. Upon termination of the contract, you take a 60-month period of time, and you figure out what their last year of compensation is. You divide it by 60, and they get that amount for each month over a 60-month period. So in this case, it's about $66,000 a month. So there's no suggestion anywhere that that was false. And that was the contention that's been made in the Rule 60 motion, that there was somehow false testimony. But all it said was that there's no error in the actual payment. There was only possibly an error in the estimated payments, and that we offer to pay you an additional amount of money just to address the error in the estimate. So to suggest that that was false testimony by Mr. Williams just simply doesn't hold water at all. The one thing that may be before the court, although it really wasn't specified as an assignment of error in the brief of my opponent, was the issue about the admissibility or not admitting the Adkins decision from the California court. Now, Judge Fallon decided during the trial, or before the trial and during the trial, that he should not admit the Adkins decision. Now, if you look at the assignment of errors, that actually is not there. They don't say there's an evidentiary ruling that's an error. But it's somewhere kind of buried in the text of the brief somewhere, so it's possibly before the court, so I want to take a moment to address that. I don't think the issue of the preclusive effect of the Adkins decision is properly before the court, and I will tell you why in just a moment. But I have to tell you, I read that California decision in the Adkins case several times, and I still really don't understand it. It's clear that Mr. Moore, in that case, sought and did obtain an injunction in that proceeding. And the one thing that the Adkins case does seem to have in common with my opponent's brief is that that Adkins decision also has no citations whatsoever to Louisiana Civil Code and no citations to any Louisiana case law whatsoever. The court in Adkins never mentioned anything about the controlling Louisiana law. So the question is, did Judge Fallon make an error in deciding not to introduce the Adkins decision to the jury in this case? Clearly, he ruled under Rule 401 that the Adkins ruling was not relevant. Judge Fallon stated it was a legal issue. It's not an issue for a jury to be trying to address what the impact of the Adkins case was. In fact, if you were to admit it to the jury, what would you tell them about it? What would Judge Fallon supposed to have told them about the Adkins case if he'd allowed to be introduced? It's kind of a confusing case. It seems to suggest that if an agent had an employee who did sign a licensed staff agreement, which wasn't the case here, and that agent had an LSA employee, which Mr. Moore never had, even though he had an employee who wanted to sign a licensed staff agreement, if you had that kind of employee, that there might have been a breach of contract involved. However, they also pointed out that State Farm has the right to pick and choose who it wants to do business with, and it can decide if it wants to do business with an employee of an agent or not. So how do you take that and tell that to a jury? So part of the decision was favorable to State Farm, stating specifically that State Farm does have the right to decide who it wants to do business with. So Judge Fallon was correct under Rule 401 in stating there was no error, in stating that it was not relevant to admit the Adkins decision to the jury. He also made a ruling under 403. And it's important to note that there were other cases that we would have liked to have introduced to the jury, because This is only one of eight lawsuits that Mr. Moore has filed against State Farm over the years. And if you read Judge Fallon's ruling, it's a very thoughtful ruling about Rule 401 and Rule 403. He said, specific holdings of courts, specific decisions of courts, I feel that it's not only irrelevant, but it's also prejudicial. And I excluded that for not only Rule 401, but 403 purposes. Once you bring in another case, then you have to bring in the entire record of the case, and then each witness has to testify, and this jury has to decide whether prior cases were right or prior cases were wrong. There are many cases throughout the country involving State Farm agents at State Farm. Many of the issues are somewhat similar, but they're different. They're different people, they're different laws, they're different issues involved. And to bring out all those cases and introduce the records in all of those cases would be, in my opinion, would be prejudicial to both sides and be irrelevant to the jury. The jury is focused on the events of this case, not what other courts, what other decision came out. So that's the reason I excluded it. Now, all you have to do is take Judge Fallon's ruling, and there was a previous ruling that's also cited in our brief where he made similar statements about his ruling, and compare that to U.S. Supreme Court's decision earlier this year in the Sprint v. Mendelsohn case, which is cited on page 39 of our brief. The court made a specific point of saying that the trial court judge has broad discretion under Rule 401 and Rule 403 to make these decisions. Wide discretion specifically is what they said. And the statement is, which I think is probably a statement of new law that came out of that decision, out of the Sprint decision, with respect to evidentiary questions in general, and Rule 403 in particular, a district court virtually always is in the better position to assess the admissibility of evidence in the context of the particular case before it.
Now, I gather that their position was that the judge made no finding of prejudice, but you've read from the trial transcript where Judge Phelan did find that there was prejudice and therefore was not going to allow this opinion into evidence. So then, if he made the balancing test and found prejudice, then we would review his evidentiary rulings under an abuse of discretion standard? Is that correct?
Yes, sir, Judge Breyer. That's absolutely right. Under the Sprint decision, because he went through the balancing test, then the decision would be, decision to admit it or not admit it would be considered an abuse of discretion standard, which the court reemphasized, the U.S. Supreme Court reemphasized earlier this year in the Sprint v. Mendelsohn case. Absolutely. Now, I would suggest to you that my opponent hasn't properly preserved the res judicata or collateral estoppel effect of the Adkins decision, because what was the jury supposed to do with that decision? They seem to be arguing, you know, the jury should have heard about this Adkins case. They should have been given some information about it. My opponent submitted a proposed jury instruction among one of 10 special jury instructions, but they didn't preserve their objection to the judge's failure to give that instruction. The trial record on the last day of the trial very clearly states that there was just a general objection by a failing to give all of the specific jury instructions proposed by the plaintiff under Rule 51 and the court's decision, this court's prior decisions. That's clearly not sufficient to preserve the objection to for failing to give the jury some kind of instruction about how to apply the Adkins decision in the lower court.
How about addressing your cross appeal about the declaratory judgment?
Yes, sir. What happened was I explained to the jury in closing argument that the effect of finding in State Farm's favor on our breach of contract claim against the plaintiff would be that he would lose his termination payments. He wouldn't be entitled to them. It's condition precedent. Basically, he had to do certain things in order to get the termination payments. When we found out he didn't do those things, we didn't just cut him off, we just came into court, which is certainly our right, filed a counterclaim, and we said he should not get those termination payments anymore. And so I made that argument to the jury. In fact, I invited the jury to rule against State Farm on that issue in my closing argument. I said,
but it's not a jury interrogatory.
It's the jury interrogatory says, do you find that State Farm breached, find Moore breached his contract? That's the question, and it's only the question in there. You're right. So the question is, what is the effect of that ruling?
Well, but did you ask the judge include a jury interrogatory, or judge in some way bring up the declaratory judgment issue for the jury, or did you just think that was for the judge to do?
Well, I did ask for specific jury instruction or jury interrogatory addressing the question of whether he He had failed to return company property within 10 days, which specifically tied back to my argument. But my belief was that the question was one of equitable relief and that it was not for the jury to decide whether or not the termination payments should be stopped or not, that that was up for the jury to judge to decide.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Assuming we affirm the decision, then you'll go back into district court with the judgment, I suppose, and seek declaratory judgment.
That's exactly what we're hoping to do, is go back to the trial judge to say, we'd like a declaratory judgment giving State Farm permission to discontinue the termination payments based on the jury finding.
In other words, if we deny your cross appeal.
If you deny the cross appeal, then would have no basis for going back to the district judge.
Well, I thought Judge Fallon's position was you didn't ask for this in this trial. And I think he says in his order you can seek relief on this later or something. I thought he included that.
I do think that there is a question about what the possible procedural options that were available to State Farm were. And certainly I agree with you that that was an option that State Farm could have gone to court to seek to enforce the effect of the judgment. But that didn't preclude us, in my opinion, from doing what we did, which was to ask for a declaratory judgment in this litigation as well. So it was a question, really, of just what the procedural choices and options were that were available to us, not necessarily we could pick or choose either one. I think we could have done several things. We could have just said, we're not paying you anymore, and just stopped the payments. I think that would not have necessarily been a very smart thing to do, since we're here on appeal arguing about whether there's still an issue here or not. So that was one thing. They could have filed a separate lawsuit, probably in state court. I guess it would have been St. Charles Parish seeking to enforce the judgment, asking for a declaratory judgment there, or possibly in the district court of the Eastern District. Or I think we had the right to do what we did, which was to come back to Judge Fallon and say, okay, here's the judgment of the jury. Here's the judgment of the court based on the jury finding. We ask you to render declaratory judgment in our favor, allowing State Farm to discontinue the termination payments based on the judge's judgment and the jury verdict. I don't think that because we chose because we didn't choose other alternatives that were available to us, that it precluded us from doing what we did. So
your time has expired.
I'm sorry. Did he then rule on your request for declaratory judgment?
It's a strange thing. First, he ruled that he denied it at first, saying we didn't pray for it in our counterclaim. But then, without us filing another motion, he went back and he changed that ruling, said acknowledged that we did pray for it, but then he said that we had abandoned the argument. We abandoned the argument that we would seek to discontinue the termination payments based on the finding of the jury. Now, my position is that we didn't abandon it because we argued it first in our counterclaim, and I actually argued it in the closing argument to the jury. It stated clearly in there that I told the jury that the effect of ruling in favor of State Farm on our counterclaim was that he would lose his termination payments under contract because he didn't meet his obligations under the contract. In fact, I actually said, although we can all go home and you can actually rule against State Farm, we can just put all this to rest. We don't have to deal with this anymore. But they thought through it and they said, well, that's not right. They actually took the extreme position, I thought, of ruling in favor of State Farm against all the plaintiff's claims and ruling in favor of State Farm against our counterclaim, which, knowing that the effect of it was that Mr. Moore would lose his right to termination payments under the contract. So the jury clearly put a lot of thought into that in coming up with that decision, because I invited them to rule otherwise so we could all just go home and put this to rest and somehow come to a conclusion with all this litigation that Mr. Moore has prosecuted. But they rejected that. So the effect of upholding Judge Fallon's ruling on the declaratory judgment, I would submit to you, is that his judgment has no effect, other than saying we can either take our chances by cutting him off on his term pay and seeing what happens with additional litigation, or we have to go to some other court or some other proceeding, and we couldn't do it within the context of this proceeding. And I think that is not consistent with the case law we cited in our brief that says an appropriate step is after the judgment to file a motion for declaratory judgment. So thank you for your time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Mallory. Mr. Thornhill, you save time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. We attach as Exhibit A to our appeal brief excerpts from the record with respect to the findings of Judge Fallon and what he said about whether it was a legal issue or a factual issue. He says, I think it is a legal issue. I don't think that it's a factual issue. Now, if it's a legal issue, we submit to you, it's reviewable as de novo. It's a legal issue that's reviewable by the court because the judge decided as a matter of law that Atkins didn't apply, but between these parties, Atkins disposed of the issue of whether or not there was a breach of contract as a result of the implementation of the LSA program. And that decision of Judge Fallon not to provide to the jury as a matter of law, that decision makes for reversible error. Now, with respect to the further comments, Judge Fallon says, and from this excerpt of page 8, it's also in the defendant's brief, they quote these same paragraphs, Judge Fallon says, I think, and this is referring to the Atkins decision, I think it may well be relevant, but I think it's a 403 reason for not granting the motion and excluding the Atkins case. Now, if it's a matter of law, it's not an evidentiary issue, I submit to you. If it's a matter of law, it's an issue that should be presented by the judge as a matter of law, and between these parties, that issue had been decided, I submit to you. Secondly, my opponent, I submit to you, inaccurately sought to summarize or minimize the effects of the false testimony of Mr. Williams, which we quote from the record on pages 58 and 59, and he didn't make some vague reference to some findings that he found. He instead specifically testified that the company had paid in accordance with the contract, the termination payments. I'll read one of the questions. Do you have any reason to believe that the company has not been paying his termination pay in accordance with the contract? No. Have you in this case done an audit of the payments made to Jim Moore's agency after April 30, 2005 to know that he was properly paid the amounts that were due to him? Answer, no, I've not done an audit, no. We attached the letter from State Farm showing that an audit, in fact, had been done within the months before the trial and that it showed that money was due.
Was he the corporate representative?
He was the corporate representative for purposes of pay. Yes, he was presented at the deposition under 30B6 as the corporate representative for those issues, and he testified at trial on those issues. Yes. Now, on the damages claim, we sought coverage under certain policies of errors and omissions insurance, and in connection with that, we pointed out that State Farm was urging in its counterclaim claims for damages which were covered. We spent lots of time on that issue, and on that issue, State Farm said in open court, unequivocally, over and over and over again, to use the words of my opponent, they said it three times, the judge ruled three times, that State Farm is not claiming any damages. It is that which Judge Fallon said prohibited State Farm from then making a claim at trial pursuant to its counterclaim for the liquidated damages, representing liquidated damages is my words, the termination of the contractually due, earned, annuitized payments called term pay. So, what Judge Fallon was saying is that State Farm represented to the court that it was not making a claim for affirmative relief. It was only seeking an offset. He said, you've told us that over and over again. We submitted to the judge that it argued, however, that it was entitled to that relief, although there was no jury verdict form question that gave them that relief because Judge Fallon said, you have openly represented to me that you have abandoned any claim for affirmative relief. You can't now come in and claim affirmative relief. So I submit to you that my opponent's artful examination of that issue with you was incorrect. And then I would lastly tell you before I run out of time that this is a case where the court could not, in California, on the seminal issue of whether or not there was a breach of contract, enjoin State Farm from violating the agent contract.
All right, your time has expired, Mr. Thornhill. Your case and all of today's cases are under submission.
Thank you, judges.
The court is in recess until 1 o'clock tomorrow.
I appreciate your time.